You're listening to episode number 9 of the RU Talks podcast series. In this episode, Dr. Linnie Wallenberg of the University of Vermont examines the global significance of agricultural and food system emissions. Dr. Wallenberg also looks at the role the public and private sectors can play in reducing these emissions. The discussion took place during the RU's lunch talk on August 8, 2019. If you have questions or comments about our podcasts, please tweet us at GCF_EVAL. That's GCF_EVAL. And remember to use the hashtag IEUPod. Thank you.
Asphalt from IEU. We'd like to welcome you to our, 20th IEU lunch talk. Perhaps as you know, we conduct this lunch talk once every month, and we'd invite people from different institutions, global thinkers who have been working on research on operational areas, on thematic areas that are relevant for the GCF. We have invited people here who talks on red class, on GIS data system, on different thematic areas. So this is a monthly lunch talk we do, and today we are very happy to invite Linnie to our lunch talk. In fact, we have known Linnie before also on our IU project, Learning Oriented Real-Time Impact Evaluation, what we call a LOTA program. We have conducted twice a workshop, once in Bangkok and the other one in Germany this year, and she has been a part of that. And this time she happened to pass through Korea, and we invite her to give a lunch talk, and we are very happy to have you here. So before I give the floor to her, let me briefly introduce who she is and invite her to the floor to give us a talk. Linnie Wallenberg, she's a professor, and she leads low emission development research at TGIR. This is a consultative group of International Agricultural Research Consortium, which is made up of different institutions, those who knows, and she works in one of those programs. I think they have restructured now, that is called CCAF, that's Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security. And she's also a research professor at the Gann Institute of Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. So she has worked extensively over years in C4, and especially in Asia and Indonesia, and she has quite a long experience on this. So today she's giving her talk on aligning agenda for food security and climate change mitigation, the race towards 2030. So the way we will run this talk is that we have about 1 hour totally, and she will give a presentation for about 25 minutes, and then we'll have about half an hour for question and answer, clarification, discussion related to that. As norm, as you see, Greg is on the back recording this talk. We'll be putting the recording on our website for external consumption and also internal consumption. So please, when you ask question, you use the microphone and introduce yourself and ask the question. With that, I'll give the floor to Linnie.
Is this mic enough? You can hear me? Okay, great. Good. So thank you very much for that kind introduction, Solomon. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I have to say, it's energizing to see all of these different faces in the room. So very, very nice to be here. Agricultural mitigation is significant, it's relevant, and it's possible. Significant because we know that 10 to 12% of global emissions come from agriculture, and we know on average for countries around the world that agriculture contributes about 30% of their national emissions. It's, I have to look at the screen to remember some of these things. It's necessary because we know that to reach the 2-degree target, we have to be able to include agriculture. We think that the energy sector is going to be mostly decarbonized. This is a bit optimistic, but we hope that the energy sector will be decarbonized by 2030. So the only remaining emissions are going to be in agriculture. and it's possible because a lot of the options are aligned with the SDGs. How many people here are familiar with the sources of emissions from agriculture? Anybody? So not too many. I'll go through this in a bit of detail then. So I think most people find it a surprise that the emissions from agriculture and the forestry sector, in other words, the land use sector, or offaloo, are larger than the emissions from the transport sector or from industry, right? So you can see, is there a pointer here? Yes, good. But which screen are people looking at? Yeah, okay. So we'll just leave it at that. You can see that agriculture is about 50% of offaloo emissions and forestry is about 50%. But in fact, agriculture drives most of the forestry emissions as well, most of the deforestation. So you could say that agriculture is the primary cause and also the source of most of the emissions in the offaloo sector. In the agriculture sector itself, now that far outer ring, you can see that most of the emissions are coming from livestock. So primarily the belching of cows, or what we call enteric fermentation, which is about 40% of emissions, a bit more from manure left on pasture, also the livestock. And then we have emissions from nitrogen fertilizer, about 13%, and emissions from paddy rice, about 10%. Those are the major sources. So quite diverse different production systems. One of the unique aspects of agriculture is that it's also a source of sinks. Okay, so we're not only producing emissions, but we also have the capacity to reduce emissions primarily in the soil, but also the above-ground biomass and the below-ground biomass. Now, this is a set of sinks in the offaloo sector generally, so the forestry and agriculture sectors, and you can see that forestry sinks comprise about 50% of the total sink, and that agriculture, what we might look here at as soil carbon and biochar, and potentially wetland restoration comprise about 50% of the rest. And agroforestry, we could count as either one. You can also see that the total estimate of the global sources of emissions, or global sources of sinks rather, is quite variable. So it can range from about 10 to 25 gigatons of CO2 equivalent. So we're not really sure how much of the sink can be achieved, in part because it's going to require behavior change. It's going to require people to do things, unlike the emissions, which are just happening. All right, so what do we think is possible to achieve, and what do we think is necessary? First, I'm going to talk about what's necessary. So to reach the 2-degree target in 2100, in other words, to limit warming, we need to reach by 2030 a target of reduction of 1 gigaton of CO2 equivalents in the non-CO2 gases. So one thing that is also different in agriculture is that we're not talking about reducing CO2 so much, we're talking about reducing methane and nitrous oxide. And the target is about 1 gigaton, or about 25% of the emissions that we expect in 2030. The timing of achieving that target is going to matter, and the timing of achieving the reductions matters. And I don't think this is a surprise to anybody at all in this room. But we know that there's a particular carbon budget that we have in order to reach the 2-degree and the 1.5-degree target. And for the more conservative target, the 1.5 degrees, that will be exhausted by 2027. We know, as I mentioned, that agriculture will be the largest source of emissions in 2030 because of what we hope will be the decarbonized energy sector, which means that in order to meet that budget, we have to reduce emissions in agriculture. So this is not a matter of taking the most cost-effective mitigation option first and chugging our way through the system until you finally get to the least cost. This is a matter of how can we meet a deadline by 2030 by moving forward on multiple fronts. We also know that the Paris Agreement is asking countries to meet net zero emissions by 2050, and we know that we have an SDG number 2, which is reducing hunger. So somehow by 2030, so somehow we have to meet that reducing hunger goal at the same time that we're reducing emissions on a very tight schedule, a schedule that asks us to have peak emissions next year, a schedule that requires us to have declining and net zero emissions by 2040 to 2050, and then to maintain negative emissions after that. So extremely ambitious. And on top of all of that, the finance for the agriculture sector is the lowest among all of the sectors. Combining both agriculture and forestry, we have only about $3 billion
in climate finance allocated to the sector in 2015 and 2016. The good news is that we have options, and we have a lot of options, and we know a lot about those options. So there are at least four core options that relate to the agronomy of how farmers are using the land. The first is paddy rice, and if you think about paddy rice fields as being like swamps that generate methane, to the extent we can drain those swamps, we reduce the methane that's being generated. So there's something called alternate wetting and drying that achieves that. With livestock systems, we know that we can improve the feed, we can change the animal and herd management, and we can improve the pasture that livestock are grazing on. With cereal crops, we know that we can increase the soil organic carbon, we can change the way nitrogen fertilizers are managed. And on perennial crops, we can transition from annual crops to crops that store more biomass, more carbon. Okay, so these are all very viable options, and we know something about them, and they're all in development. We know even more about high carbon landscapes, whether that's forests or peatlands, mangroves, grasslands, and that is happening on its own, I think, outside of the agriculture sector, but it involves agriculture. And then we have three options for which we don't know as much, and where I think there's real scope for action. One is reducing food loss and waste in the supply chain, in part because businesses and value chains generally, the actors in the value chain have a lot of incentives to increase efficiency. So for them, any increase in efficiency has an economic incentive and will also, for the most part, reduce emissions. The energy use in the supply chain, same rationale. And finally, and most controversially, shifting diets. And I say controversially, but in fact, when I first started in this position, I wasn't even allowed to put this on slides. And now you can look at the stocks of Impossible Burger and Impossible Foods or Beyond Burger, and you can see that these companies are actually making great strides and people are starting to talk about it. And the Rockefeller Foundation now has a whole program on alternative proteins. So it's now a viable option. So these are what I would call our eight core options. There are other options as well, but these are things that we can really start to look at and prioritize. I'm going to talk about two examples, one in the public sector and one in the private sector. So first example, public sector, because it involves irrigation, and mostly the public sector is responsible for large irrigation infrastructure. This is that paddy rice drainage that I referred to, and it can achieve up to 50% reductions, real reductions in emissions, and also save water. So farmers can adopt it for the adaptation benefits that it provides, and in coastal areas for reducing saline intrusion, for example, which is how it's used in the Mekong River Delta. It can also reduce pumping costs and the fossil fuel uses associated with that. It reduces the tendency of rice to fall over, lodging, it's called, when the grains get very heavy, because the roots tend to grow more widely as you drain the field. The roots are looking for water, so you get a stronger plant. And it tends to reduce pest populations, too. There are lots of issues, though, as with any of these technologies, because the farmers have to be able to drain the fields. The farmers might have different incentives. Some of them can't, don't necessarily have pumped water. It sometimes causes increased weeding, and sometimes there are pulses of other gases. So sometimes we have trade-offs between reducing methane and, for example, N2O emissions from fertilizer. But the very good news is that we tend to have net revenues, in fact, increases in revenues. So for an example of AWD in Vietnam, we knew that this reduced costs, as you can see in the upper left, but what we didn't know is that it was going to increase the revenues as well in the upper right, in fact, increase revenues more. And so the net benefits were quite high. And Vietnam has launched a pretty aggressive program to support upscaling. And one of the tools that they're using is to map the suitability in different, or nationally and then in provinces, and then allocate their resources accordingly. And we found that to be a really great tool for large-scale implementation of this practice. Similarly, at large-scale implementation, or an example of large-scale implementation in Thailand, the very first rice Nama has now been financed by the Nama facility. Thailand is the fourth largest global emissions of greenhouse gases from rice globally, and the project is reaching about 100,000 farmers, so not huge scale. But across six different provinces, so it has the opportunity to scale up, and we think it'll reach about achieve about a million tons of CO2 equivalents reduction. So not huge, but it's a start. The second example is more related to the private sector and nitrogen fertilizer, which is dominated by the fertilizer industry primarily, the private sector fertilizer industry. We know that improving fertilizer efficiency on your field can reduce emissions intensity by about half. And emissions intensity here, of course, refers to the emissions per unit of food. You can do this mostly by just improving the what they call the four R's, which relate to the right timing, the right amount, the right type of fertilizer, and the right placement of the fertilizer, but also just good agronomy. The problem is that most farmers in developing countries are using small amounts of fertilizer. And so most people are going to be increasing their overall fertilizer rather than increasing the efficiency of the fertilizer use. And so over time, we're going to see an increase in emissions from fertilizer. And that's a difficult dilemma for the agriculture sector and the climate world in general. This is true for the livestock sector as well, generally. Some sectors, in order to grow, are going to increase emissions, and our task is to minimize those emissions. The really cool thing about the nitrogen fertilizer, though, is where you do have farmers who are operating at pretty intensified levels of intensified farming, you can have a lot of gain if you improve the efficiency. So in Mexico, for example, CIMMYT, one of our partners, one of the CGIAR centers, used a technology that they had developed with this hand sensor for called NDVI, and they were able then to sense the amount of nitrogen precisely that was needed by the crops, and now they're employing drones to fly over fields with these sensors and now make recommendations to farmers, and the farmers are able to not only save the amount of fertilizer and the cost that they would have otherwise spent, but also they're reducing their emissions by exactly 1% of that 60 to 70 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. So it adds up. Just to give you, those are examples of work actually that CCAFS is doing. I wanted to highlight other areas of work to give you a sense of the breadth of work that's needed and happening in this area. So in terms of climate finance, for example, the Climate Bonds Initiative is developing criteria and indicators for sustainable finance in the agriculture sector. Just yesterday, I got an email saying that China now wants to also develop a set of indicators for sustainable finance, so this is an area of growth. Impossible Foods, they're working with us as well to assess the investment case for this, for protein sources that would be appropriate to developing countries. Right now, they rely on a very high-tech soy product called heme, but we want to look at some grasses, for example, and whether that's possible to use to promote a plant-based meat alternative. We're also supporting countries generally on improving the monitoring of their emissions in the livestock, agroforestry, and rice sectors. We're collaborating with the private sector in China on dairy greenhouse gas footprinting, and as Solomon said, we're working with the LORTA group on impact assessment. All right, so now I'm going to shift a little bit. We're going to talk about strategies, because of course there are all these wonderful options, but what are we going to do? What's the most important thing to do? So I imagine you guys talk quite often about how to prioritize the largest mitigation opportunities. We've just been through a prioritization process with the World Bank and the Transformational Carbon Asset Facility, which is going to start a pilot project in Pakistan, and developed this decision tree where you look at the significance of emissions in terms of absolute emissions. You look at the significance of emissions in terms of the percent contribution to either global, national, or project level emissions. Then you look at the incentives associated with that, both adaptation and other benefits. And then you look at a set of enabling conditions related to how well technology can be transferred, what's the reinforcing policy, and to what extent you have finance, a favorable finance environment. And so you can see on the left, to the extent we meet all of those basically criteria, we give that a high priority. To the extent we meet only reduced emissions intensity, we give that a low priority. And anything more or less that's a combination of that becomes a medium priority. So this became a pretty useful tool for prioritizing where the mitigation potential was highest. And then you can look at which countries, of course, emit the most. And in agriculture, the shocking thing is that only four countries plus the EU contribute about 50% of the emissions globally. And they're, you know, not the surprising, the countries are not that surprising. You know, China, India, EU, Brazil, and the United States. You could extend that further and take the top 12 countries plus the EU, and you achieve 3/4 of the emissions. So really, it's a limited number of countries that we're dealing with in terms of targeting. But, of course, there's a problem, because the countries with the highest emissions are not always the ones that are planning action. So if you look at the NDCs, and this is a map of the NDCs showing in deep orange the countries that have committed to mitigation targets in agriculture, in light orange, the countries that have committed to an economy-wide mitigation, but nothing specific about agriculture. So it's assumed that perhaps agriculture is part of that. And then the rest you don't need to worry about. But you can see that there's some gaps. So India and China are not up there. And you can see that in contrast, there are a lot of African countries that want to do mitigation, even though they might not be the highest priority. So somehow we have to look at this combination of the countries that are the highest emitters that matter for impact, and the countries that want to take action. And how do we do that? And in the last 10 years in CCAFs, we've been trying to balance that by recognizing that the countries that want to take action, besides the fact that they could benefit from climate finance to achieve sustainable development in their food sector, which is of interest to us, is that they also tend to be regional leaders, and they can provide entry points and good lessons. So we've tried to figure out how to prioritize to get the biggest impact with the big emitters, as well as the countries that can be leaders, but without sacrificing impact. And that's the operative word, without sacrificing impact. So where is action possible? I think it's important to recognize that because the food sector is so sensitive, countries have developed really different strategies policy-wise around mitigation in agriculture. So we see really strong commitments in Costa Rica, Mexico, and Uruguay, and in the past, we've seen a strong commitment in Brazil, but not presently. We have conditional commitments in China, Vietnam, and Colombia based on fairness. In other words, if you do it, we'll do it. And some countries have said that they will do it if they receive finance, in particular Kenya, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Indonesia, and Pakistan. And then we have a set of countries that have just said no way. India has really been the leader in the negotiations in this regard, in that they want to prioritize adaptation. But I want to say that despite those formal positions and despite the NDCs, what we see is that these are just indicators and they're limited. That in fact, if you look a little bit more deeply, most countries are doing something. I just mentioned Thailand with the NAMA. Philippines is also doing quite a bit with alternate wetting and drying. And we just did a survey of soil organic carbon in the NDCs, and we found only 10 countries had made a formal commitment to soil organic carbon. But in fact, when you dug just a little bit beneath the surface, almost all of these countries had, because agriculture is an important sector, many activities related to enhancing soil organic carbon. I mean, even high priority policy mandates. So I think we need to think out of our climate boxes, and we need to sink into the reality of agricultural policy and not just climate policy in determining what kind of action is possible. And one statistic to keep in mind is that we know that agriculture, and this is based on pretty old MAC curves, but we think that agriculture can achieve about 25% of its full potential at a price of about $20 per ton of CO2 equivalents within existing production systems. The way to translate that is agricultural development on its own can probably achieve 25% of the agricultural mitigation potential. So as an example of that, we did a footprint of USAID's agricultural investments. This was for about 25 different projects in 15 different countries. And you can see here on the left a series of mitigation relevant actions related to landscapes. And then as we move across, things more related to agronomy and management practices. And you can see in blue where we have carbon sequestration and in yellow where we have emissions. And the overall message from this is the emissions mostly are increasing, as I explained earlier, from the fertilizer and the livestock industry, but we have compensation with carbon sequestration across a number of these different sectors, and in rice we also have mitigation. So the net effect of the portfolio is mitigation. And that's something else to really keep in mind, is that by looking at project by project level, we might not see mitigation, but looking at broad portfolios, especially across landscapes, we can. We also just did a survey of examples of large-scale implementation, because CCAFS has this transformation initiative and commitment to large-scale implementation. So we looked at 24 different examples of quite successful projects, either because they had large-scale agricultural development implementation or because they were carbon projects that had some evidence of success. And what we found was that, indeed, very large numbers of people, participants are possible, very large numbers of hectares are possible, and quite significant benefits are possible. As you would imagine, most of these cases were in large populations, so you can see here China, Nigeria, India, but we also have cases from, for example, in East Africa, where we had relatively modest numbers, but quite significant benefits and impacts. So we think that there's good evidence for being able to achieve these transformational large-scale impacts in agriculture. We also tried to extract what were some of the design principles from these projects, and some of them were fairly obvious and some not so. So we have a list here, and the overall categories are, first, can you have good technology transfer? So for example, there has to be a value proposition for the farmer, and either local government or farmer-driven change is essential. For finance, I'm going to go into that in a moment. Good monitoring is essential, especially at low costs. And with policy, we found that it really, really mattered to have reinforcing policy at multiple sort of layers of policy underlying any of the interventions. And it was critical to have action in all four areas. So just having action in one was not enough. So on finance, what are some of the most important points? I think it's essentially using public finance to leverage private sector investment. The agriculture sector is really driven by private sector. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's massive in the private sector. So first is, enhancing the incentives. We found in these scale implementation projects that either subsidy reform or some form of credit was essential to stimulate the innovation. And there's a really interesting project in Vietnam right now called AgResults, where they're creating a prize to farmers to innovate in order to reduce emissions, and they are finding all kinds of entrepreneurial action happening as a result of that. So just a stimulation with a bit of capital, in this case through prize money. Then expanding the technical services available. Obviously, some of these techniques are not already mainstream. We're seeing interesting examples of digital platforms, for example, in Uruguay. New business models in Brazil. The farmers were not, they were absentee farmers. They weren't present to do the change that was needed in the management of their livestock. So a whole business called Pesca grew up for professionals to start managing the livestock and the pasture in ways that were consistent with mitigation, and the landlords just pay them. The landowners just pay them. So that's pretty interesting. But generally also there's a huge need to develop ministry capacities and to also think about the equity involved in access to some of these technologies. There's a need to invest in the infrastructure, irrigation for paddy rice. Vietnam is thinking about major overhauls in their irrigation infrastructure. Manure treatment needs infrastructure as well, often quite costly. And finally, for the long term, and I really think we can't ignore the need for vastly new options. In the long term, we need R&D on some pretty exciting opportunities. So one is low emissions rice. URI is now doing trials of rice that you could share the seed, and the farmer doesn't have to do anything except just plant that seed, and that rice is already reducing emissions. Basically, rice is like a straw, and if you reduce the amount of methane that passes through that straw, you reduce the amount of methane emissions. So there are some very simple ways of addressing this. Low emissions cattle is a longer term proposition, but people are working on that as well. Just a week, there's a global meeting on breeding low emissions cattle. And as I mentioned, alternative meat is an area that's fast growing right now, reducing food loss and waste. Biomaterials in Tokyo, I don't know if anybody's seen these skyscrapers built out of timber. So there's a whole area emerging, nanofibers made out of woody materials as well, that will help sequester carbon. And then notions of circular economy, where we can have more efficiency using waste and making that an input into the production system. And finally, improving emissions estimates. agriculture is still an area where cheap monitoring of agriculture emissions doesn't exist in ways that are precise. So we're thinking about, you know, how can you use machine learning sensors and blockchain in MRV systems. So just to wrap up, we know that agriculture can contribute to the 2-degree goal, but it's been slow in terms of progress, and that finance has been particularly low. We also have lots of evidence of the feasibility of large-scale impacts, whether, you know, successful business models or these large-scale projects that I designed. I don't think we're quite there yet with proving the case entirely, but we're kind of on the cutting edge of that. So the question now is how to bring together the priority countries where we think we can have huge impact together with some of those large-scale design features and be able to develop improved feasibility in those systems. So catalyzing the large-scale change, especially through working with the drivers in agriculture, being able to build on those design principles, and then using the public finance to leverage private sector finance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leni, for this excellent presentation. There is a lot of information to digest. What we're gonna do is I'll open the floor. We're gonna take two rounds of questions, and then you're gonna respond to that. I'll collect 2-3 questions, then I'll give you a chance. The floor is open for questions, clarification. Stephen.
Okay, I did not understand 1 or 2 slides, so that's why I'm asking the question on it. I remember earlier the slides you were showing, 2020 would need to be the peak year. That means from that moment on, pollution needs to go downwards. But you didn't give us a flavor of how it's currently looking with the pollution. What are you predicting for next year? And then the second one I really didn't grasp, but it's important. So you talked about that 25% contribution realistically from the agricultural sector within that sector. I didn't fully understand it. As a kind of reduction opportunity. That's how I interpret it, but it might be wrong. So I'm curious on your opportunity forward going, because if you have 25% opportunity now once, it would take about 20 years for the population increase to make that up, because the increase of the population demands for agriculture would grow in 20 years by 25%. So, what's the trick to do that perpetually afterwards?
I'm very much interested on, you know, we hear a lot of stories about how the...
you introduce yourself for her in order. Oh.
We hear that the beef is a significant culprit in emissions in terms of value chain and procurement. So how serious it is and what we have to do to reduce it. That will be my first big question. Second question is related to finance. Why you think there are so many blockages in bringing finance to emission solutions to agriculture? And is there a key of how to de-risk certain investment streams to agriculture?
For second round.
Sorry. You use the mic. They're recording, so sorry.
Hello? Okay, hello. My name's Bridget. I'm just an intern. But I had a question. So when I had done a little bit of work on this for my master's thesis, there was an issue of evaluating the long-term stability of soil carbon sinks. And so you mentioned a lot the sinks and their importance in counteracting some of the other emission sources. Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, has there been a development recently? Like, what kind of estimations do we have, and how are we increasing our understanding of that?
I'll go back to the slides to help with the discussion. Sorry, this computer is different than mine. See, Okay. So your question was about the if we're achieving the 2020. No, not even close. So agricultural emissions are predicted to increase to about 2050, and they're expected to not quite double, because we're going to have some reductions with intensification and development that increase the efficiency, the greenhouse gas efficiency of food production. So we're somewhere between 5 and 5.8 gigatons of CO2 equivalents now per year. And believe it or not, by 2030, I think we're only about 5.8. So, you know, if you consider actually now the average is about 5.4, the average will be about 5.8 in 2030. So the growth in emissions is happening slowly relative to the amount of food that we expect to be produced. On the 25% of mitigation potential, that number reflects, let's see if I find that here. There, is that the number you're talking about? The one at the bottom there? And your question was looking forward, if the production increases, how can we keep up with that? So, you know, as I mentioned, actually the increased production and the intensification of production will already start to increase the efficiency of greenhouse gases in our agricultural production system. So I don't see it as a problem to do a one-time fix. And one of the really interesting things is, because intensification is happening, let's say over a 20-year period, which I think is not unusual for agricultural development cycles, you know, for a new technology to come through and to have a significant amount of adoption, we have many countries, especially, for example, in the livestock sector, that are starting to intensify and can adopt the best technologies possible. So there'll be some leapfrogging, I think, happening, potentially, especially if we intervene early, that will allow countries to have the highest greenhouse gas efficiency available. So on the beef culprit, yes, it's the highest emissions, and it's certainly a source of emissions, and there's very little that we can do to reduce absolute emissions in livestock. You know, the best that you can do in most developing countries for now is probably improve the feed and consider the herd composition in some cases, and improve the pasture. And so you're improving the emission intensity. Yeah. That being said, I'm still hopeful in the next 20 years that we'll have a low emissions cow, right? And I also think that potentially the technology for additives to the diet, which are now becoming cost effective in the north, the global north, will become cost effective in the south, global south. And at that point, at least for the intensified systems, the commercial systems, we could have real reductions in methane, I think. So on the, what are the blockages in finance? You know, talking to different banks, what I hear most is a couple of things. The bankability of projects, a lot of projects are not necessarily providing the levels of return, or don't necessarily have the finance channels, the credit distributors, so to speak, on the ground, the rural banks, the infrastructure of the rural banks. But also the numbers of, just the sheer numbers of smallholder farmers are hard to reach. So I have thought, why don't we just focus on the medium and large farmers first? And which means that you have a massive trade-off with development, but it's where the finance is most possible. Yeah. On de-risking, you know, if you're talking about de-risking the agricultural production itself, then I think you need to combine this with climate information services and adaptation, not mitigation alone. Yeah. And then Bridget, thank you for asking about soil carbon. It's one of my favorite topics. Yeah. You know, there's so much hype right now around soil carbon as an offset to emissions. And what we do know is that the amount of carbon that can be stored in the soil is finite. So it might be stored only for 5 years before it reaches an equilibrium, or 10 years, or possibly 20 years, maybe 30 at the most, but probably more closer to somewhere between 10 and 20 years in most systems, right? And then you're done. You can't store anymore. It's like growing a forest. It doesn't grow anymore after a certain period of time. But the other thing is that it's reversible, right? That if somebody decides to plow the soil again, for example, or there's a huge erosion event, you could lose all of your soil carbon. So it's less permanent than the greenhouse gas emissions opportunities. I also think that there's been a vast overestimate of the what's possible in soil organic carbon. And people, I mean, we could go through, I have a slide somewhere, a list of at least 13 constraints, like the types of inputs into the soil. Farmers are often competing for, you know, using the crop residues for either fuel or for fodder. You often need to enhance nitrogen in your system in order to increase. This is a really important point. You often need to fertilize in order to enhance soil organic matter, but the emissions from fertilizer offset any benefit that you get from soil organic carbon. So those interactions are also important.
Thank you very much. I'll go for second round. I'll give it to Seble, and then Cornelius, and then I'll take the third one, and we could go to the next round and after. And I'll invite also at some point Jamie to comment. I know she arrived now. I'll give you a chance later to just comment and try to wrap it up. Given this thematic area is much more linked to her portfolio, if you could sum it up at the end, I'll give you a chance.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm the gender and social specialist. My question is to something that you have said something about, but not really much about, is about behavior change. So how big of an issue is that at different levels? You know, the governments can make commitments, but then the translation of that happens at the community level. And in some countries, they are really talking about their livelihoods and not really about how they make more money out of the business. So how big a problem or a challenge is it? And then how much of an investment is currently going into that aspect of things or should be going into that part of the work? Thank you.
My name is Cornelius. I'm an intern at the IU, and my question is very closely related. So is the biggest bottleneck for change, is it a lack of finance that is available for projects, or is it the awareness, is it the demand, especially considering that some of the technologies that you presented have the potential for efficiency improvements?
I've got a couple of questions. I've also worked on this area before I joined. I joined FAO, GCF when I was in FAO, about these different agricultural technologies with potential to reduce carbon emission and so on. And vis-a-vis, of course, increase in productivity and translating into income and so on, especially when we look at countries like in sub-Saharan African countries or in Asian countries, where there is a trade-off, right? So they would promote certain kind of soil and water conservation structures that would reduce emission, but that would come at a cost over time. And you have touched a little bit. If you could comment on that, how could we could upscale some technologies which have got higher mitigation potential, but at the same time having high adaptation or a resilience potential? If you could comment on that. The second point is with respect to fertilizer usage. You said, I think that argument would hold in a country like India and China, where there is a large scale and the fertilizer consumption rate is much more higher per unit area of land. But if you go again to African countries where the consumption of fertilizer or the input use is very low, I don't know how much emission could you save by investing in fertilizer usage, if you could comment on that. Thank you. Yeah.
So on behavior change, I think it's a huge question, and especially consistency in management, right? We might be able to achieve a behavior change, but is it going to be the maximal level that we see on experiment stations? Probably not. So I'm a real believer in farmer innovation and not just top-down systems, and I think what we need to start working on is how to have both the bottom up and the top down. So CCAFS, for example, has what we call climate smart villages. And what we found is that the farmers are selecting the technologies, obviously, that matter most to them. And very few of them are these the technologies that I've described here. Actually, the predominant technology is agroforestry, for example. So we have to reconcile what's possible and what's going to be desirable and prioritized by the farmers with what's happening and prioritized from us. So that leads me then to the second question, which is what's the biggest bottleneck, and it's the incentives, like first and foremost incentives, but then it's also, I think, the technology and capacity building, right? So somehow we have to bring those together. Uruguay, again, is a good example where the government has created this platform where they allow, it's super, you know, farmers can do everything from scenarios of climate change to identifying different mitigation options, so they can plan what they want to do and they can develop the business case for that. And then they get a small grant from the government that allows them to actually test or try some of these things. So I think bringing together that catalytic incentive together with the technology is going to matter. And then Solomon, on adaptation and mitigation trade-offs. You know, we talk a lot about the synergies possible between adaptation and mitigation, but when you look at adaptation very strictly in terms of adaptation to, you know, for example, rainfall variability, there are very few technologies that overlap. So, you know, most of the adaptation technologies that we see are about water, and none of the mitigation options that I just described to you really affect water directly, except for the alternate wetting and drying, right? We find that carbon sequestration in the soil and carbon sequestration in the biomass are the two areas where you tend to have the most synergy between the two, because you're buffering temperatures, for example, or you're buffering water with the soil. On fertilizer, absolutely, India and China, or regions within countries. So, for example, Mexico, the intensified maize systems or intensified wheat systems are where we're going to find the most gains with fertilizer reduction. But I don't think that should stop us from seeking efficiency in fertilizer elsewhere so that we're not ending up with excessive use as other systems develop. And the fertilizer companies seem to be on board with that because they're looking for this kind of guidance as well in sub-Saharan Africa. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much. I'll go for the last round. Jenny, are you ready to intervene? And if there's other question, I'll give you a chance. Okay, and then after Jenny. Let me give it first to him, and then I'll give it to you, Jenny. Then you wrap it up and link to your GCF, how it relates to that, and then I'll give the final floor to you. Yeah.
Thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. My name is David from OPM. My question is with regard to population growth and its impact on agricultural mitigation, because we see that the population growth is likely to increase quite significantly to 2030 and 2050 and beyond. And some of the areas where the population growth is greatest are the areas which were in red there, where there's already some effort, probably not too much. But with the population growth, probably we're going to have inevitably people moving into forest areas and reducing the existing carbon sinks there. What is your view on that?
Okay. So can I speak now? Okay, thank you. Well, first, my apology for being late. I was in another meeting, but thank you, Lini, for, I'm sure the presentation was really interesting, and thank you for IU for inviting. I think just in regard to what, I mean, we're collaborating a lot already with CCAF and Lini and other and the team, so that's really great. We're trying to develop the GCS strategy for the sector, building on some of these knowledges and evidence that are being generated by partners. So I think where we are now and GCF and I mean for the sectors, there's agriculture food security, although we say, I mean, there's a lack of finance, but it's quite huge in our portfolio as well as in the pipeline. So that really reflect well the country, I mean, NDCs and other priorities that have been set up and different documents in terms of the adaptation, but we do have also quite a lot on cross-cutting. But the mitigation potential are not really harvested so far. I mean, we do not have projects and the sector really targeting the mitigation benefits that can be generated. It's often there's also, it's put as co-benefits, so it's not even always acknowledged as cross-cutting. They're not, there seems to be anyway a bit of reluctance in terms of having to monitor and report it. although we do have, we are able to finance that if, you know, I mean, if it's significant mitigation benefits. So we're trying to always, when they're significant, that it would not be just co-benefit, but rather the project would be cross-cutting so that this is being reported on. Otherwise, we lose these, I mean, that's get lost in the reporting of the projects. But what do we see is that the pipeline needs to change, needs to become much more innovative, much more catalytic. Like the example you mentioned from Uruguay, that's quite interesting to see that they are having these sorts of, you know, very like platform, very bottom up to create these business cases. So I think these we want to work at in different streams, and one could be more like private sector and looking at where we can put our financing to really just de-risk or create some larger scale impact where there can be a lot of mitigation potential. And you mentioned medium, larger scale farmers, but also these types of things also in Uruguay when we could kind of be more catalytic. So those types of projects are not coming yet, really. We have more classical projects in terms of, I mean, water management, resilient agriculture, but I think going forward, that's the purpose of the strategy, that we would like to point directions where, as GCF, we can really add value and have more impact. And the sector, as you've also mentioned in the presentation, it's really important to look at other drivers of changes and other barriers. I mean, we know land tenure, we know incentives. So a lot of these things have to be looked at together, no, if we're to drive a bigger change. So so that's a bit where we are now. We're developing the approach to develop the strategy, but that work has to, you know, we have a consultation that is planned in Canada, in Ottawa, at the end of August, and then two more in October, and then we hope to finalize the strategy by the end of the year. And it's great that CCAF is already involved. I mean, we're working closely, so I'm really thankful for that. And I think I'll stop it here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jenny. I'll give you the last word. If you have any advice to GCF, where investment should go, Jenny indicated going forward the kind of areas where GCF is looking at it. This is your floor to make an impact on her and the other people around here too.
Thank you. Just to address the first question, I think that is part of the challenge, is that we know food production does have to increase. So my own feeling is that in West Africa, for example, the mitigation potential is relatively limited. Let's focus on vulnerability. So let's, you know, triage the places where we expect food production to be most vulnerable and not necessarily approach mitigation there. And in fact, that's not a mitigation priority region, for example. And on forest cover and deforestation, I do think that we have to be pretty strict about avoiding deforestation in the future, because the emissions from deforestation are vastly higher than anything that we're going to achieve in the agriculture sector. And so avoiding deforestation is probably the priority. But I think what I want to leave you with as a note of optimism, and I'm going to talk to Janie later about strategy elements specifically, is just to say that in the last 10 years, you know, with the CCAFS program, you know, we started and almost nobody ever talked about mitigation in agriculture. And really now we're seeing momentum in terms of the investment community, in terms of the development community, in terms of countries. Nobody guessed that we'd have over 100 countries making NDC commitments. And it's happening. It's really happening. So I think as long as we have the intention and the vision and we realize it's possible, we just have to figure out how to make it work. And I think we can. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jenny, and we'll wrap up our session. Thank you, everybody, for coming also.